Hello, and welcome to Robbinsdale Revisited. I'm Crystal Boyd, a member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. In this episode, we're taking a closer look at the history of racial covenants and how they shaped the neighborhoods we know today, especially here in Robbinsdale. Like many communities across Minnesota, Robbinsdale's early development tells a story about who was encouraged to live in certain places and who was deliberately excluded. In the late 1800s, when Andrew B. Robbins first began developing what would become Robbinsdale, the practice of writing racial restrictions into property deeds hadn't yet become common. Robbins purchased large parcels of land, platted them into lots, and began building rental homes and selling property in what we would now call subdivisions. His early developments in the 1890s attracted only a handful of homes at first, especially after an economic depression slowed growth. But by the early 20th century, that pattern began to change. Starting around 1910, 1915, and becoming widespread in the 1920s, developers across Minneapolis and its suburbs began inserting racial covenants into property deeds. These clauses legally restricted who could buy, rent, or even occupy a home. They often stated that the property could only be sold or occupied by people of the Caucasian race. In some cases, the restrictions went even further, attempting to regulate who could stay overnight as a guest. Though these covenants were eventually ruled unenforceable and banned in Minnesota in 1953, the language remains in many property deeds today. Much of what we know about these covenants comes from the groundbreaking work of the Mapping Prejudice Project. This initiative has mapped thousands of racially restrictive covenants across the Twin Cities by digitizing historic property records and working with volunteers to identify discriminatory language in old deeds. Their work helps us visualize just how widespread these restrictions were and how they shaped patterns of segregation that still influence our communities today. Another organization working to address this legacy is the Just Deeds Project. Just Deeds helps homeowners legally remove racist covenant language from their property records. Even though the restrictions can't be enforced anymore, many people feel strongly about removing that language from the deeds of their homes. The organization also helps cities and residents better understand how these historical practices affected neighborhoods across the region. In this episode, we'll explore how these covenants appeared in Robbinsdale's subdivisions, from developments in the 1920s through neighborhoods built as late as the 1940s. We'll look at who the developers were, how these communities were marketed, and how the language in those deeds helped shape who could live in places like Glenwood Manor, McNair Manor, Sanborn Terrace, and other neighborhoods throughout the area. So join me and the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, Pete Ritchie, as we dig into the story of racial covenants in Robbinsdale. Understanding this history isn't about assigning blame to people living in these neighborhoods today. Instead, it's about recognizing how policies and practices from a century ago helped shape the communities we inherited, and how learning that history can help us move forward with a clearer understanding of our past.
We're going to talk about racial covenants, and we're going to talk about the neighborhoods of Robbinsdale and how they came about. Andrew B. Robbins is the first person who shows up and builds what we would call a subdivision here. He buys 80, 90 acres, plats it, starts selling lots, builds some rental homes to begin with. Then he gets kind of wiped out by a depression in the 1890s. And the places he platted, you know, they probably got 18, 19 houses built there in the 1890s. And then they started filling in after that. I've had people ask me about racial covenants going back that far. It just wasn't the practice at that time. The earliest covenants that I've ever found date back to about 1915, 1916. And then they became very common practice as these neighborhoods were platted, subdivided after World War I. So really in the 1920s is where you find them.
And Pete, could you remind me, what is a racial covenant?
So It's in the deed itself, and it usually states that you can't sell this property, rent this property, sometimes even have somebody spend the night or have a guest on this property that is not white. Sometimes they would be a little more elaborate in the case of Sanborn Park and Robbinsdale, where they list off a variety of nationalities. For the most part, I've never found one in Robbinsdale that excludes people on the basis of religion. And I was told that there was a famous court case where a Jewish man took somebody who had put a racial covenant to court. Eventually, it got passed through the legislature that you couldn't discriminate on the basis of religion. So those are harder to find than the racial covenants.
But the racial discrimination continued. And I think some of them have exceptions for servants. You could only sell the property to a white family, but they'd make an exception and say, but it's okay if your servant is a person of color. And so they really were pretty restrictive.
Yeah, as common practice, really. And we'll go through some of the neighborhoods in Robbinsdale here. The last neighborhood that we'll go through was called Snyder's Addition, and it was over there on Crystal Lake. And this is the late 40s, and they're including racial covenants on every one of those. Those are the latest ones. Most of them are from the 1920s. And of course, in the state of Minnesota, racial covenants were outlawed in 1953. Before I dig into all these Robbinsdale neighborhoods, what were some of the neighborhoods in Golden Valley that had racial covenants?
Great question. If you visit the Golden Valley Historical Society right on Golden Valley Road and look across the way towards the park, that whole neighborhood there is a hotbed of racial covenants. And they really are all across Golden Valley. Mapping Prejudice is an amazing website where you can go and see these hot spots. And like Pete said, they're mostly from the 1910s to the 1950s, early 1950s. But we have some examples of them, and they were actually advertised that way. I think, Pete, you have some advertising examples too, but
lots. Yeah, although they were a little bit sneaky about it. You know, proper restrictions are in place.
Yes, wisely restricted, we have a brochure that says. So if you read between the lines, you can tell what that means. But that's what they were alluding to, that these places were not open to people of all colors.
Talking about these things in general, I was reading an oral history, and it was from the Wright family, who was a black family that bought a farm in Crystal in 1917. And it was an oral history done in 1971 with the son of the man who had bought the farm. And he was talking about how many African Americans were in the Twin Cities at that time. And he specifically was talking about farmers, and he felt like he probably had met at some point every black farmer that was in the whole state. And his family was owned some rental properties in Minneapolis, and so they were renting out to black families. But one of the things he said is there were probably 300 to 400 black families in Minneapolis. When I first started looking into racial covenants and how prevalent this was throughout the Minneapolis suburbs, and you start doing some of the math, if every black family had moved into Robbinsdale, it makes me think that this was the real estate industry whipping up fear, finding an angle to bring in people to buy these properties. And the comparison that was made to me one time is the amount of laws that were being written about people who are trans. When you look at the number of people who are trans and the number of laws, I am sure that they would have excluded African Americans who came to those neighborhoods, and it wouldn't have been an easy time because there was a lot of prejudice. But the covenants themselves, I hate to say, were almost used as marketing. They wanted people to know.
Yeah, fear-based marketing. But yeah, in Winnetka, they also had these racial covenants. And there's even an example of where they would pay the streetcar fare for white people to come out and see the subdivision, but only if you were white. I don't know exactly where it was, but we have a copy of the advertisement. Property restrictions have been placed on every lot, ensuring a good neighborhood and neat, attractive homes.
Mm-hmm.
The one for Delphian Heights says, new, beautiful, highly restricted residential sites.
The first neighborhood that I dug into was the western portion of Robbinsdale. There's almost a little panhandle that sticks out to the west on the other side of what's now Highway 100. The furthest west toward the Crystal border there is called Glenwood Manor. And that was the edges of the Stillman farm, which took up most of the acreage over there. And Horatio Stillman, who had settled it, and then his wife was Margaret Stillman, and then they had a daughter named Maud who lived in Robbinsdale for many years after that. But when he dies in 1920, the executor of his will, one of his descendants, starts working with this real estate group called the Confer Brothers. And I'm going to try and name the real estate groups in each one of these neighborhoods. And the Confer Brothers took out all sorts of ads in the Minneapolis paper. They would point out that this really isn't nearly as far away from the central business district as Lake Harriet, for instance. It's going to be closer to downtown. There's a streetcar that's nearby. It's going to get you back and forth to downtown. And Sam Confer and his wife, Mary, they appear as the sellers on most of these properties. They must have bought the entire farm and then they platted out. And then that's where the racial covenants come in, because you can see this is the person who owns the lot, and here's the covenant that they've placed on each one of these little lots. In the case of Glenwood Manor, a racial covenant says premises may be sold, rented, or otherwise disposed of to people of the Caucasian race. So it's a quick one sentence to each lot. It's not even going to be with the paperwork. When you buy a house, you're going to have to go to the county records to find the original deed for the lot. Work with an organization like Just Deeds, who was started by Maria Cisneros. And what's her role in Golden Valley?
I believe she's the city attorney. Yeah, and a lot of homes today still have those racial covenants. They can't be enforced, so they were ruled illegal in Minnesota in 1953. But your home, if you live in the West Metro, might still have that on your deed. And that's exactly what this organization, Just Deeds, can help with. Because it can be really emotional for people to learn that their home, this investment that's so attached to their lives, was really a tool of racism and segregation. So if that hits you, you can reach out to Just Deeds. They'll help you. They do a good job recognizing that it's just a first step to take that language off your deed, that there's a lot more work that needs to come beyond that. But it is a good way to start to learn about the subject and to start taking action in a way that can be helpful.
Yep, and they can help homeowners, but they can also help cities and municipalities that want to grapple with this. And they provide free legal and title services, along with access to other online tools and volunteer opportunities.
And I'm glad that you mentioned cities, because there's 9 cities in the Bassett Creek watershed, and I noticed that all of them are participating in Just Deeds except Medicine Lake. And so that's a question I now have. Were those houses built at the time when racial covenants were being used? So that's some research I need to do.
I'm just going to read a little bit of their description of Glenwood Manor. They say, "You'll be surprised when you see this acreage. It is in the midst of a rapidly growing neighborhood. Some fine residences are located here. The ground is already cultivated for your garden. Fine, rich soil. Besides having a home virtually in the open country, so close to the business district that you can keep your position in the city. You will be able to raise enough money on your acreage to pay for it. One suburbanite made over $1,000 on an acre of onions, and another over $1,000 on an acre of strawberries. Here, too, is an excellent place to raise poultry."
$1,000 of strawberries? That sounds amazing.
Well, you know, over the course of the summer, you're going to get a few batches of strawberries, and you can certainly turn over your onion field at least once or twice. To this day, when you go through this neighborhood, you'll see these little houses that were built in the 1920s. Sometimes you'll still see the skip lot. Other times you'll see a newer house right next to them, because they eventually would have sold their skip lot. The next neighborhood is Robbinsdale Home Gardens. So right next door to Glenwood Manor, there's 2 little strips. And then after that, there's a little thing called Strawberry Acres. They were mostly developed by the Confer brothers. There's a couple little lots that may have been done by somebody else. And again, the use of racial covenants is ubiquitous through all of them. So Robbinsdale Home Gardens, you've got quarter acre tracts. They're going for $295. The advertising is always pointing out where Robbinsdale is. Just in case you didn't know, Lake Harriet is much further away from the central business district than Robbinsdale. So this is in 1917. You've got the Miller and Herbert families, and they worked with the Reedhead Company Realtors to subdivide between 42nd and 46th Avenues North. So this is east of Veracruz and over to Toledo Avenue North. And in 1918, the Reedhead Company formed a partnership with Edgar Noyes Realty and a former druggist named Henry Bugelli. The Robbinsdale Home Gardens properties were marketed as thrift lots with room to grow food and raise chickens, and the buyers were urged to come out where the taxes were going to be low and plant a garden as soon as they could make a down payment. So before you even built your house, you could come out here and have your little country garden. And easy payments of $10 a month on the newly paved Rockford Road. And it's near the Robbinsdale streetcars, and they were running down to the Loop District every 20 minutes. You had a quarter acre tracks, and they were located on high level ground containing rich black soil. Here is the best property near Minneapolis to plant a garden on your own land this week. Cut the high cost of living by producing your own fresh vegetables, eggs, chickens. You got high-level lots, best garden soil. It's near schools and churches and the car line, banks and stores and lakes. Most of the houses have electric lights, a full line of plumbing, and up-to-date in every respect. Reasonable building restrictions, whether that's coded advertising or not, every one of these properties had a racial covenant. The houses started getting built in the 1920s, just like in Glenwood Manor. The racial covenant that was included by Reedhead and Noyds on this property was that they shall not be assigned, sold, or leased to the grantee, his heirs, administrators, or assigns to anyone except a person of the Caucasian race. Not a lot of wiggle room there. But in 1913, several families worked with Glick Brewing to create this Crystal Heights subdivision. And it's just to the west of France Avenue there and on either side of 36th. The group again went to work with this Albert P. Reedhead Company to sell off their 350 lots. And so Crystal Lake Heights is a little bigger than some of the other neighborhoods we've talked about so far. They were trying to bring them in from South Minneapolis again, because that was our competition. Why would you build way out there by Lake Harriet when we have this nice lake here, this Crystal Lake? You only had to put $5 down, and then maybe you were going to pay $5 a month. It was right on the streetcar line, so they advertised that.
There's this great advertisement that says, trees like these require a lifetime to grow. And it's got this picture of like two trees. Because they don't look that big.
They were telling you that your lots had some nice trees that you weren't going to have to.
Well, I suppose if everything had been cut down for firewood, those are comparably pretty big trees.
Well, this, you know, starting in 1913, some of the other advertising slogans were note the new location of the car lines and the cars are going to be running over this new line by 1914. Yes, it has every advantage that every other place has. Buy now. These aren't the greatest advertising slogans. In Crystal Lake Heights, we've got a pretty standard racial covenant in every one of these properties. Says said properties will not be assigned, sold, or leased by grantee, his heirs, or administrators, or assigns to any person not of the Caucasian race. So McNair Manor was named for an attorney and a businessman, William McNair. He was born in 1836. McNair served as the county attorney and mayor of St. Anthony from 1869 to 1871. He was highly regarded as a defense attorney in 1893. He declined a nomination to run for governor. He became the Democratic nominee for the United States Representative in 1876, but lost the job to Jacob H. Stewart. And shortly before his death in 1885, he made arrangements with the Minneapolis Park Board. He had hoped to see a four-mile parkway created from Fairview Park in North Minneapolis down to Cedar Lake. Well, they created a parkway. It didn't quite follow that route. So after World War I, the Ewald brothers built a dairy pasteurizing plant on Xerxes Avenue and Golden Valley Road. The Ewalds built a horse barn across the street, and that horse barn becomes a parking lot for their milk delivery trucks. And in 1923, the Ewald family left the McNair farm, and over 170 acres were acquired by the city of Minneapolis. And the rest of the land was purchased by the Metropolitan Bank of Minneapolis, and the land was divided into building lots. The name of the real estate company was Dickinson and Gillespie. So McNair Manor takes up the south portion of Robbinsdale. It takes up a little bit of Golden Valley and a tiny piece of Minneapolis, too. Lots of twisting streets, and these streets were laid out in the early 1920s. Some of them have islands. If you go down Zenith, it's got an island down the middle of the street. They varied a little bit from your grid pattern, and the lots were a little bit bigger. So they lay all this out in the 1920s, and they are doing everything they possibly can to attract people out here. Their model home was built at 26 and Zenith, and it's still standing. So up and down Zenith Avenue, you've got a few houses that were built in the 1920s. Dickinson Gillespie had gone bankrupt a couple times. On all of the lots that they created, they had racial covenants. And the racial covenant in McNair Manor was no person or persons other than of the Caucasian race shall be permitted to occupy said premises or any part thereof. Over $250,000 was spent on the development before the houses were even built. There was a 50,000-gallon water tank that was erected on the corner of Parkview Boulevard and 27th Avenue North. So Dickinson and Gillespie tried every trick in the book to promote the development and attract home buyers. They had picnics, parades, stunt flyers, parachute drops. They gave away free thimbles and electric irons. Drawings were held for $1,000 worth of prizes. And in 1929, a six-cylinder Chevrolet coach was given away. Just if you would come look at their houses, you could enter yourself into one of these contests. A couple dozen homes were built, mostly along Zenith and York Avenues, but most of it remained largely vacant. In 1931, the residents in Robbinsdale and Golden Valley petitioned the city of Minneapolis to annex the area, but services eventually improved, and the water tower came down in 1935, and the area, it really didn't fill in till after World War II. The funny thing about that water tower is we have there's a big hill in that neighborhood, and it's called Tanker Hill by all the kids when I was growing up. And to this day, it's still called Tanker Hill, and none of us ever knew why. You'll notice most of it was built after World War II, but the houses are modest, and the houses that were built in the 20s are actually a little bit grander. So now we're coming to another one of the larger neighborhoods in Robbinsdale. So the history of Sanborn Terrace and Victory View. So we're on the east side of Robbinsdale now, north of Crystal Lake for the most part. It's got the history of this little area has gotten a little more attention lately because it's been proposed that the name of Sanborn Park be changed. And we'll talk about the Sanborn family here and how the park came about. Sarah Josephine Gates is born in 1851, and she moves to what's now Minneapolis from Hubbardston, Massachusetts, when she's just 4 years old. Her family homestead was located at what's now 2426 West Broadway, and Gates was one of the first female students at the University of Minnesota. She married Charles Hammond Sanborn, and the couple settled on a 100-acre farm near Crystal Lake in the 1870s, and they had two daughters. And the Sanborns were involved in this Crystal Lake Village and the township that came before Robbinsdale. But Charles Sanborn dies in 1892. So it's fair to say that the Sanborns, at least this part of the family, never really lived in Robbinsdale because Robbinsdale because it doesn't become a village or a city until in 1893. After Charles dies, that takes a long time for the dust to settle on his will. There's some proceedings in probate court. Sarah Josephine Gates Sanborn has just enough money to build herself a house at 2602 Thomas Avenue North, and she raises her daughters. They both graduate from the University of Minnesota, and they became teachers. One married a school principal, and the other one married the dean of the university's graduate school. It's easy to follow this family around through old newspapers. They tend to show up on the society pages whenever somebody gets married, whenever somebody joins the garden club. They're at the flower show. They're at fancy dances. After the dust has settled on the will, between 1902 and 1914, Sarah Josephine Gates Sanborn works with a variety of real estate partners. They plant and start selling off the family's land in North Minneapolis. And two of the biggest sections are what's now called Sanborn Terrace and then Victory View. So there are probably over 1,000 lots in these two pieces of property. What's now Sanborn Park was donated to the city. And it took me a while to figure out that it wasn't the Sanborn family that donated it. It was David C. Bell, which was the real estate organization they were working for. I think he looked at this piece of land. It used to be a dump. It's awfully swampy. Maybe the city would like it for a park. I don't think we should build there. So they build all the way around Sanborn Park for a couple blocks, and then they fill in Victory View. On July 20th, 1921, Sarah Josephine Gates Sanborn forms this thing called the Sanborn Holding Company. So she still owns the land, but she's working with David C. Bell to sell the lots. And she brings in Charlotte Sanborn Helberg, and their properties become Sanborn Terrace and Victory View subdivisions. And the Sanborns then work with David C. Bell. And at that time, he was one of the larger real estate organizations in Minneapolis, and they eventually become a nationwide real estate company. And they still had an office here in the 1970s that was over at 3357 Lilac Drive. Now, when you look through the racial covenants that the Sanborns used, it was far more elaborate than almost anything else I've seen. And they would say that the said property of the second part hereby agrees that the premises hereby conveyed shall not be at any time conveyed, mortgaged, or leased to any person or persons of Chinese, Japanese, Moorish, Turkish, Negro, Mongoloid, or African blood or descent. So if you're Korean, you're welcome there, right? Because it's just not mentioned. I mean, most of these racial covenants just don't list things off that way. It seems like there's a lot of wiggle room there. But that was what they used on every one of their properties. When I see this, you know, the next name on the deed is the Sanborn family. So it doesn't seem like the real estate agent ever had. I mean, I'm sure he encouraged the use of racial covenants, but if you want to lay, did they know this was there? They knew. There is no way they added that to their deeds when their name is on the deed, not David C. Bell, the real estate company. So then it comes down to, should we have a park named after this family? Well, if you want to quibble about it, you could say, well, is it named after Charles Sanborn? This all happened after he died. I don't think it's named after Charles Sanborn. They're calling the subdivision Sanborn Terrace, but at this point, his descendants and his wife are the ones who are running the company. And I think they're naming it after themselves. So do you want to have a park named after somebody who developed a whites-only neighborhood? And I think that's that sometimes gets lost in this discussion of why we would ever rename this park. The first thing that happens, well, it's been Sanborn Park. When I was growing up, it was Sanborn Park. That's what we call it. We couldn't possibly call it anything else. And of course, my answer to that is I had a woman explain to me, well, I had this friend when I was growing up, and her name was Johnson, and that was what I always called her. Her name was Jenny Johnson, and then that's just the name that I know her by, and all of my memories are attached to her with that name. Well, then she got married, and now her name isn't Johnson anymore. It's Larson, and I don't know. Well, you can change. Names can be changed. Sometimes there's a pretty good reason to change the name. For some reason, the city council, you know, has had this presented to them, and they've talked about how we name our parks in the city. And I think they even created a commission to discuss how should we decide what our parks are named after. And it was more or less decided that maybe we shouldn't name parks after people. You know, there could be something problematic about that. And so it was thought, well, we should name parks after something in the landscape.
Well, the last I heard was that the commission had been through a whole variety of names that were submitted by the public, and they had also considered finding some names in the Dakota language, because these are the traditional and contemporary homelands of Dakota people. And I think that might be an interesting way to view the Sanborn story. So Sarah Josephine Gates is born in 1851 in Massachusetts, and that's actually the same year as the Treaty of Mendota and the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux. And those are the treaties that open up a lot of southern Minnesota to Euro-American settlement. So when she comes here, when she's 4 years old, her opportunity to be on this land really comes from Native American treaties that some have argued were coercive, that they weren't totally upfront with how they were presenting those treaties. So Robbinsdale today is still on the contemporary and traditional homelands of Dakota people. So it's just a new way to see the suburb. And what I thought was really interesting about this particular restrictive covenant is that it didn't mention Native American people, because it's so specific, it doesn't mention Native Americans.
Yeah, I can't help but read the language in that and think of all the people that it does not exclude, which I am sure is why this particular covenant, I have never seen it anywhere else. And I've just done a little perusing of what some of the language in these racial covenants are, and there's nothing else out there like that one.
But it is such an interesting question of how do we remember the past? Who do we memorialize? How do we memorialize them? I think it's a great question, and it should be open to discussion and change. So I'm really interested to see where the city of Robbinsdale goes with it.
Well, I think they are going to take it up again this spring. As we talk a little bit more about these two subdivisions, they again don't fill in really until after World War II, but some great houses get built in the 1920s and a few in the 1930s. And they were a little bit grander than a lot of the things we see in Robbinsdale, particularly over there along Victor Memorial Drive, which just looked like a more desirable neighborhood.
They're obsessed with Lake Harriet. This one, too, says outside the city limits, but just as convenient to urban facilities as the south shore of Lake Harriet.
That's right. They want to bring up South Minneapolis all the time as if Robbinsdale could ever compete with the parkways and the beauty and the big houses. Victory View leads us into Snyder's Victory Memorial Edition. And of course, we could spend an entire episode on Victory Memorial Drive. The real estate people really thought they had something here. But in 1940, Fred B. Snyder works with Thorpe Brothers Real Estate and Mortgage Company, and they open a new area known as Snyder's Victory Memorial Drive. And they've got 75 lots, and this is between 36th and 38th Avenue. They do a little bit slightly different layout of the streets. The streets get a bit of a curve. Not only does the picturesque, gently rolling ground on which the addition is laid out lend itself to modern architecture and landscaping, but the home sites themselves are large. There are no tiny, crowded lots in the addition. The location of the addition is just to the south of Crystal Lake and Robbinsdale. It's convenient to transportation, schools, churches, shopping districts. The Minneapolis Loop is just 10 minutes away by automobile. The country is but 5 minutes away. Water connections and graded roads have been completed and paid for, and the building restrictions follow the usual for the best type of home site development. So again, is this our coded language? What are they telling us about those restrictions? The racial covenant that was placed on these lots, and again, this is so much later, we're 20 years later than the covenants that were used in Sanborn and Victory View, and no lot shall be sold, conveyed, leased, or rented to any person other than of the white or Caucasian race, nor shall any lot be occupied by any person other than the white or Caucasian race. So slightly different language, but not the wiggle room of naming off ethnicities that the Sanborns used in their covenants. And this was really the last real estate development or place to fill in Robbinsdale that used racial covenants, because when we get into 1953, you were no longer going to put those in there. And I think we've gone through all of the major subdivisions and all the realtors that were using racial covenants in Robbinsdale now. You know, these were the ones that were done by the professionals and the ones that were easiest to find. The covenants put on early, like even 1915, 1920, they almost always restrict racial groups. I've never seen one in Robbinsdale that restricts people on the basis of religion. I'm guessing, again, that's because the Minnesota legislature stepped in, I believe, 1919. And said that you could not discriminate on the basis of religion.
And just as a reminder, you can reach out to Just Deeds. Your property deed might still have that language in it. It's not enforceable, but you can get it expunged. They will help you take that language out if you don't want that on your deed.
Yeah. Another thing that maybe would lend context is how active the Ku Klux Klan was in the 1920s in this part of town. In Robbinsdale, we know that they were marching up and down West Broadway in full regalia. I think the account that's in Helen Blodgett's book was 200 Klansmen marching. We know that there were mass meetings held in wherever the Robbinsdale Ravine was.
Well, and that's a great lead into something when we think about intent versus impact. Here we are 100 years later, and we can map that impact.
And it was certainly a little more obvious when I was growing up. And even when we look at newspaper articles from the 1960s, where the Robbinsdale Human Rights Commission has these realtors in front of them, and they're asking them, hey, how come there are no black people in Robbinsdale? There's black people in Brooklyn Center. I mean, when I was growing up, everybody I knew that wasn't white lived on the other side of the parkway. I don't think I knew a black family that lived in Robbinsdale, and that was the 1970s.
Yeah, and even in the 80s and 90s when I was in Golden Valley, if I look back at my kindergarten yearbooks, there are some people of color, but majority white. And so that impact lasted decades.
So it's definitely still with us, regardless of what the intent was. And again, I think the intent was to sell homes to the people that were we're out here buying, and I just, whether or not a Black family ever came out to look at any of these homes or was ever interested, we'll never know. What we do know is that the Wright family, who had bought their farm out in Crystal in the early 1950s, and I believe it was after 1953, they subdivided their property and they were selling, and they had hoped to bring people they knew from the city who were Black out to Crystal. And the realtors were not having it, and they were harassed, and they ended up, their friends did not move out there.
And there are some recent examples. If you're interested in another podcast, the Hahawak Padan or Bassett Creek Oral History Project has a podcast, and people of Indigenous backgrounds from the West Metro talk about how difficult it was to buy a house, things that they talked about when they were renting or buying a property in the West Metro. So you can see more modern examples of that, like today, how that legacy has come down across the generation.
Catherine Lee Scott mentioned a Japanese family, and I noticed that they show up in the yearbooks. And they would have come in, you know, right after World War II, and I wonder what their story was like purchasing a house out here.
Well, I have to give some major credit to the Mapping Prejudice Project. I think they are an amazing example of how technology can combine with community volunteers and academic pursuits to create a true community project. A lot of this information is only available because they digitized the deeds and volunteers went through and looked for this information.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.